narrative describes a society in which people assume that other people are not transgender and not gay unless there is information to the contrary. In response to this essay, which Olivia sent in an email to CMC staff, Mary Spellman, the Dean of Students at CMC, sent her a private email 2 days later. Here is the entire email. Olivia, thank you for writing and sharing this article with me. We have a lot to do as a college and community. Would you be willing to talk with me sometime about these issues? They are important to me and the Dean of Students staff, and we are working on how we can better serve students, especially those who don't fit our CMC mold. I would love to talk with you more. Best, Dean Spellman. What do you think about Dean Spellman's email? Cruel or kind? Most readers can probably see that she was showing concern and reaching out with an offer to listen and help. But Olivia was offended by the dean's use of the word mold. She seemed to interpret it in the least generous way possible, that Spellman was implying that Olivia and other students of color do not fit the mold and therefore do not belong at CMC. This was clearly not Spellman's intent. Olivia herself had asserted that at CMC, there is a prototype or pattern of identities that she does not match. And as Spellman later explained, she used the word mold to express her empathy with Olivia because it's a word that other CMC students use in conversations with her to describe their sense of not fitting in. Any student who was already feeling like an outsider might well feel a flash of negativity upon reading the word mold. But what should one do with that flash? There's a principle in philosophy and rhetoric called the principle of charity, which says that one should interpret other people's statements in their best, most reasonable form, not in the worst or most offensive way possible. Had Olivia been taught to judge people primarily on their intentions, she could have used the principle of charity in this situation, as Carith Foster did in the situation described in the previous chapter. If a student in Olivia's position was in the habit of questioning her initial reactions, looking for evidence, and giving people the benefit of the doubt, that student might get past her initial flash of emotion and avail herself of an invitation from a dean who wanted to know what she could do to address the student's concerns. That is not what happened. Instead, Olivia posted Spellman's email on her Facebook page, about 2 weeks after receiving it, with the comment, "I just don't fit that wonderful CMC mold. Feel free to share." Her friends did share the email, and the campus erupted in protest. There were marches, demonstrations, demands given to the president for mandatory diversity training, and demands that Spellman resign. Two students went on a hunger strike, vowing that they would not eat until Spellman was gone. In one scene, which you can watch on YouTube, students formed a circle and spent over an hour airing their grievances through bullhorns against Spellman and other administrators who were there in the circle to listen. Spellman apologized for her email being poorly worded and told the crowd that her intention was to affirm the feelings and experiences expressed in the article and to provide support. But the students did not accept her apology. At one point, a woman berated the dean, to cheers from the students, for falling asleep during the proceedings, which the woman interpreted as an act of disrespect. But it is clear from the video of the confrontation that Spellman was not falling asleep. She was trying to hold back her tears. The university did not fire Spellman, but neither did its leaders publicly express any support for her. Faced with the escalating anger of students, amplified by social media and then by national news coverage, Spellman resigned. As this was happening, another conflict over an email was unfolding at Yale. Erica Christakis, a lecturer at the Yale Child Study Center and associate master of Silliman College, one of Yale's residential colleges, wrote an email questioning whether it was appropriate for Yale administrators to give guidance to students about appropriate and inappropriate Halloween costumes, as the college dean's office had done. Christakis praised their spirit of avoiding hurt and offense. But she worried that the growing tendency to cultivate vulnerability in students carries unacknowledged costs. She expressed concern about the institutional exercise of implied control over college students and invited the community to reflect on whether, as adults, they could set norms for themselves and handle disagreements interpersonally. Talk to each other, she wrote. Free speech and the ability to tolerate offense are the hallmarks of a free and open society. The email sparked an angry response from some students, who interpreted it as an indication that Christakis was in favor of racist costumes. A few days later, a group of roughly 150 students appeared in the courtyard outside Christakis's home within Silliman College, writing statements in chalk, including, "We know where you live." Erica's husband, Nicholas Christakis, was the master of Silliman, a title that has since been changed to head of college. When he came out to the courtyard, students demanded that he apologize for and renounce his wife's email. Nicholas listened, engaged in dialogue with them, and apologized several times for causing them pain. But he refused to renounce his wife's email or the ideas it espoused. Students accused him and Erica of being racist and offensive, stripping people of their humanity, creating an unsafe space, and enabling violence. They swore at him, criticized him for not listening, and for not remembering students' names. They told him not to smile, lean down, or gesticulate. And they told him they wanted him to lose his job. Eventually, in a scene that went viral, one student screamed at him, "Who the fuck hired you? You should step down. It is not about creating an intellectual space. It is not. It is about creating a home here. You should not sleep at night. You are disgusting." The next day, the president of the university sent out an email acknowledging students' pain and committing to take actions that will make us better. He did not mention any support for the Christakises until weeks after the courtyard incident, by which time attitudes against the couple were entrenched. Amid ongoing demands that they be fired, Erica resigned from her teaching position, Nicholas took a sabbatical from teaching for the rest of the year, and at the end of the school year, the pair resigned from their positions in the residential college. Erica later revealed that many professors were very supportive privately, but were unwilling to defend or support the Christakises publicly because they thought it was too risky and they feared retribution. Why did students react so strongly to the emails from Dean Spellman and Erica Christakis, both of which were clearly intended to be helpful to students? Of course, there was a backstory at each school. There were incidents of racism or other reasons why some students were frustrated with the administration. The protests were not just about the emails. But, as far as we can tell, those backstories don't involve Spellman or Christakis. So why did students interpret the emails as offenses so grave that they justified calls for their authors to be fired? It's as though some of the students had their own mental prototype, a schema with two boxes to fill, victim and oppressor. Everyone is placed into one box or the other. Groups and tribes. There's a famous series of experiments in social psychology called the minimal group paradigm, pioneered by Polish psychologist Henri Tajfel, who served in the French army during World War II and became a prisoner of war in Germany. Profoundly affected by his experiences as a Jew during that period in Europe, including having his entire family in Poland murdered by the Nazis, Tajfel wanted to understand the conditions under which people would discriminate against members of an outgroup. So in the 1960s, he conducted a series of experiments, each of which began by dividing people into two groups based on trivial and arbitrary criteria, such as flipping a coin. For example, in one study, each person first estimated the number of dots on a page. Irrespective of their estimations, half were told that they had overestimated the number of dots and were put into a group of overestimators. The other half were sent to the underestimators group. Next, subjects were asked to distribute points or money to all the other subjects, who were identified only by their group membership. Tajfel found that no matter how trivial or minimal he made the distinctions between the groups, people tended to distribute whatever was offered in favor of their in-group members. Later studies have used a variety of techniques to reach the same conclusion. Neuroscientist David Eagleman used functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRI, to examine the brains of people who were watching videos of other people's hands getting pricked by a needle or touched by a Q-tip. When the hand being pricked by a needle was labeled with the participant's own religion, the area of the participant's brain that handles pain showed a larger spike of activity than when the hand was labeled with a different religion. When arbitrary groups were created, such as by flipping a coin, immediately before the subject entered the MRI machine, and the hand being pricked was labeled as belonging to the same arbitrary group as the participant, even though the group hadn't even existed just moments earlier, the participant's brain still showed a larger spike. We just don't feel as much empathy for those we see as other. The bottom line is that the human mind is prepared for tribalism. Human evolution is not just the story of individuals competing with other individuals within each group. It's also the story of groups competing with other groups, sometimes violently. We are all descended from people who belonged to groups that were consistently better at winning that competition. Tribalism is our evolutionary endowment for banding together to prepare for intergroup conflict. When the tribe switch is activated, we bind ourselves more tightly to the group, we embrace and defend the group's moral matrix, and we stop thinking for ourselves. A basic principle of moral psychology is that morality binds and blinds, which is a useful trick for a group gearing up for a battle between us and them. In tribal mode, we seem to go blind to arguments and information that challenge our team's narrative. Merging with the group in this way is deeply pleasurable, as you can see from the pseudo-tribal antics that accompany college football games. But being prepared for tribalism doesn't mean we have to live in tribal ways. The human mind contains many evolved cognitive tools. We don't use all of them all the time. We draw on our toolbox as needed. Local conditions can turn the tribalism up, down, or off. Any kind of intergroup conflict, real or perceived, immediately turns tribalism up, making people highly attentive to signs that reveal which team another person is on. Traitors are punished, and fraternizing with the enemy is too. Conditions of peace and prosperity, in contrast, generally turn down the tribalism. People don't need to track group membership as vigilantly. They don't feel pressured to conform to group expectations as closely. When a community succeeds in turning down everyone's tribal circuits, there is more room for individuals to construct lives of their own choosing. There is more freedom for a creative mixing of people and ideas. So what happens to a community, such as a college, or increasingly a high school, when distinctions between groups are not trivial and arbitrary, and when they are emphasized rather than downplayed? What happens when you train students to see others and themselves as members of distinct groups defined by race, gender, and other socially significant factors, and you tell them that those groups are eternally engaged in a zero-sum conflict over status and resources? Two kinds of identity politics. Identity politics is a contentious term, but its basic meaning is simple. Jonathan Rauch, a scholar at the Brookings Institution, defines it as, quote, political mobilization organized around group characteristics such as race, gender, and sexuality, as opposed to party, ideology, or pecuniary interest, end quote. He notes that, in America, this sort of mobilization is not new, unusual, un-American, illegitimate, nefarious, or particularly left-wing. Politics is all about groups forming coalitions to achieve their goals. If cattle ranchers, wine enthusiasts, or libertarians banding together to promote their interests is normal politics, then women, African Americans, or gay people banding together is normal politics too. But how identity is mobilized makes an enormous difference for the group's odds of success, for the welfare of the people who join the movement, and for the country. Identity can be mobilized in ways that emphasize an overarching common humanity, while making the case that some fellow human beings are denied dignity and rights because they belong to a particular group, or it can be mobilized in ways that amplify our ancient tribalism and bind people together in shared hatred of a group that serves as the unifying common enemy. Common Humanity Identity Politics. The Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. epitomized what we'll call Common Humanity Identity Politics. He was trying to fix a gaping wound, centuries of racism that had been codified into law in southern states and into customs, habits, and institutions across the country. It wasn't enough to be patient and wait for things to change gradually. The civil rights movement was a political movement led by African Americans and joined by others. Together, they engaged in nonviolent protests and civil disobedience, boycotts, and sophisticated public relations strategies to apply political pressure on intransigent lawmakers while working to change minds and hearts in the country at large. Part of Dr. King's genius was that he appealed to the shared morals and identities of Americans by using the unifying languages of religion and patriotism. He repeatedly used the metaphor of family, referring to people of all races and religions as brothers and sisters. He spoke often of the need for love and forgiveness, hearkening back to the words of Jesus and echoing ancient wisdom from many cultures. Love is the only force capable of transforming an enemy into a friend. And darkness cannot drive out darkness. Only light can do that. Hate cannot drive out hate. Only love can do that. Compare King's words to these from Buddha. For hate is not conquered by hate. Hate is conquered by love. This is a law eternal. King's most famous speech drew on the language and iconography of what sociologists call the American civil religion. Some Americans use quasi-religious language, frameworks, and narratives to speak about the country's founding documents and founding fathers, and King did too. When the architects of our republic wrote the magnificent words of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, he proclaimed on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial, they were signing a promissory note. King turned the full moral force of the American civil religion toward the goals of the civil rights movement. Quote, even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. King's approach made it clear that his movement would not destroy America, it would repair and reunite it. This inclusive, common humanity approach was also explicit in the words of Pauli Murray, a black and queer Episcopal priest and civil rights activist who, in 1965, at the age of 55, earned a degree from Yale Law School. Today, a residential college at Yale is named after her. In 1945, she wrote, I intend to destroy segregation by positive and embracing methods. When my brothers try to draw a circle to exclude me, I shall draw a larger circle to include them. Where they speak out for the privileges of a puny group, I shall shout for the rights of all mankind. A variant of this ennobling common humanity approach played a major role in the movement that won marriage equality for gay people in several statewide elections in 2012, paving the way for the Supreme Court to rule that gay marriage would become the law of the land. Some of the most powerful advertisements of those 2012 campaigns used King's technique of appealing to love and shared moral values. If you want to experience the emotion of moral elevation, just go to YouTube and search for Mainers United for Marriage. you'll find short clips showing firefighters, Republicans, and Christians all appealing to powerful moral principles, including religion and patriotism, to explain why they want their son, daughter, or coworker to be able to marry the person he or she loves. Here's the audio from one such ad, featuring an Episcopal priest and his wife. Husband: our son Hal led a platoon in Iraq. Wife: when he got back, he sat us down and said, "Mom, Dad, I'm gay." Husband: that took some getting used to, but we love him and we're proud of him. Wife: our marriage has been the foundation of our lives for 46 years. Husband: we used to think civil unions were enough for gay couples. Wife: but marriage is a commitment from the heart. A civil union is no substitute. Husband: our son fought for our freedoms. He should have the freedom to marry. This is the way to win hearts, minds, and votes. You must appeal to the elephant, intuitive and emotional processes, as well as the rider, reasoning. King and Murray understood this. Instead of shaming or demonizing their opponents, they humanized them and then relentlessly appealed to their humanity. Common enemy identity politics. The common humanity form of identity politics can still be found on many college campuses. But in recent years, we've seen the rapid rise of a very different form that is based on an effort to unite and mobilize multiple groups to fight against a common enemy. It activates a powerful social psychological mechanism embodied in an old Bedouin proverb. I against my brothers, I and my brothers against my cousins, I and my cousins against the world. Identifying a common enemy is an effective way to enlarge and motivate your tribe. Because we are trying to understand what is happening on campus, in what follows in this chapter, we'll be focusing on the identity politics of the campus left. We note, however, that developments on campus are often influenced by provocations from the right, which we will discuss in Chapter 6. Provocations from the right mostly come from off-campus, where the right is just as committed to identity politics as is the left. There has never been a more dramatic demonstration of the horrors of common enemy identity politics than Adolf Hitler's use of Jews to unify and expand his Third Reich. And it is among the most shocking aspects of our current age that some Americans and Europeans, mostly young white men, have openly embraced neo-Nazi ideas and symbols. They and other white nationalist groups rally around a shared hatred not just of Jews, but also of blacks, feminists, and SJWs, social justice warriors. These right-wing extremist groups seem not to have played significant roles in campus politics before 2016. But by 2017, many of them had developed methods of trolling and online harassment that began to have an influence on campus events, as we'll discuss further in Chapter 6. As for the identity politics originating from left-leaning on-campus sources, here's a recent example that drew a great deal of attention. In December 2017, a Latino student at Texas State University wrote an opinion essay in his school's student-run independent newspaper under the headline, "Your DNA is an Abomination." The essay began like this: "When I think of all the white people I have ever encountered, whether they've been professors, peers, lovers, friends, police officers, etc., there is perhaps only a dozen I would consider decent." The student then argued that whiteness is a construct used to perpetuate a system of racist power, and asserted that through a constant ideological struggle in which we aim to deconstruct whiteness and everything attached to it, we will win. The essay ended with this: "Ontologically speaking, white death will mean liberation for all. Until then, remember this: I hate you because you shouldn't exist. You are both the dominant apparatus on the planet and the void in which all other cultures, upon meeting you, die." Right-wing sites interpreted the essay as a call for actual genocide against white people. The author seems, rather, to have been calling for cultural genocide, the end of white dominance and the culture of whiteness in the United States. In any case, the backlash was swift and severe and came from both on campus and off. From off campus, the paper received hate mail, calls for resignations, and even death threats. More than 2,000 people signed a petition to defund the student paper. Fire defended the newspaper's First Amendment rights. The student editors quickly apologized, retracted the article, and fired the writer. The president of the university called the essay a racist opinion column and said she expected the student editors to exercise good judgment in determining the content that they print. In calling for the dismantling of power structures, the author was using a set of terms and concepts that are common in some academic departments. The main line of argumentation fell squarely within the large family of Marxist approaches to social and political analysis. It's a set of approaches in which things are analyzed primarily in terms of power. Groups struggle for power. Within this paradigm, when power is perceived to be held by one group over others, there is a moral polarity. The groups seen as powerful are bad, while the groups seen as oppressed are good. It's a variant of the pathological dualism that Rabbi Sacks described in the quotation at the start of this chapter. Writing during the 19th century Industrial Revolution, Karl Marx focused on conflict between economic classes, such as the proletariat, or the working class, and the capitalists, those who own the means of production. But a Marxist approach can be used to interpret any struggle between groups. One of the most important Marxist thinkers for understanding developments on campus today is Herbert Marcuse, a German philosopher and sociologist who fled the Nazis and became a professor at several American universities. His writings were influential in the 1960s and 1970s as the American left was transitioning away from its prior focus on workers versus capital to become the New Left, which focused on civil rights, women's rights, and other social movements promoting equality and justice. These movements often had a left-right dimension to them. Progressives wanted progress, and conservatives wanted to conserve the existing order. Marcuse therefore analyzed the conflict between the left and the right in Marxist terms. In a 1965 essay titled Repressive Tolerance, Marcuse argued that tolerance and free speech confer benefits on society only under special conditions that almost never exist, absolute equality. He believed that when power differentials between groups exist, tolerance only empowers the already powerful and makes it easier for them to dominate institutions like education, the media, and most channels of communication. Indiscriminate tolerance is repressive, he argued. It blocks the political agenda and suppresses the voices of the less powerful. If indiscriminate tolerance is unfair, then what is needed is a form of tolerance that discriminates. A truly liberating tolerance, claimed Marcuse, is one that favors the weak and restrains the strong. Who are the weak and the strong? For Marcuse, writing in 1965, the weak was the political left, and the strong was the political right. Even though the Democrats controlled Washington at that time, Marcuse associated the right with the business community, the military, and other vested interests that he saw as wielding power, hoarding wealth, and working to block social change. The left referred to students, intellectuals, and minorities of all kinds. For Marcuse, there was no moral equivalence between the two sides. In his view, the right pushed for war, the left stood for peace. The right was the party of hate, the left the party of humanity. Someone who accepts this framing, that the right is powerful and therefore oppressive, while the left is weak and therefore oppressed, might be receptive to the argument that indiscriminate tolerance is bad. In its place, liberating tolerance, Marcuse explained, would mean intolerance against movements from the right and toleration of movements from the left. Marcuse recognized that what he was advocating seemed to violate both the spirit of democracy and the liberal tradition of non-discrimination, But he argued that when the majority of a society is being repressed, it is justifiable to use repression and indoctrination to allow the subversive majority to achieve the power that it deserves. In a chilling passage that foreshadows events on some campuses today, Marcuse argued that true democracy might require denying basic rights to people who advocate for conservative causes or for policies he viewed as aggressive or discriminatory, and that true freedom of thought might require professors to indoctrinate their students. Quote, "The ways should not be blocked by which a subversive majority could develop, and if they are blocked by organized repression and indoctrination, their reopening may require apparently undemocratic means. They would include the withdrawal of toleration of speech and assembly from groups and movements which promote aggressive policies, armament, chauvinism, discrimination on the grounds of race and religion, or which oppose the extension of public services, social security, medical care, etc. Moreover, the restoration of freedom of thought may necessitate new and rigid restrictions on teachings and practices in the educational institutions which, by their very methods and concepts, serve to enclose the mind within the established universe of discourse and behavior." End quote. The end goal of a Marcusean revolution is not equality, but a reversal of power. Marcuse offered this vision in 1965. It should be evident by now that the exercise of civil rights by those who don't have them presupposes the withdrawal of civil rights from those who prevent their exercise, and that liberation of the damned of the earth presupposes suppression not only of their old, but also of their new masters. The student who wrote that essay at Texas State University may not have read Marcuse directly, yet somehow he ended up with a Marcusean view of the world. Marcuse was known as the father of the New Left. His ideas were taken up by the generation of students in the 1960s and 1970s, who are the older professors of today. So a Marcusean view is still widely available. But why does this vision continue to flourish 50 years after the publication of Repressive Tolerance, in a country that has made enormous progress on extending civil rights to groups that did not have them in 1965? And in an educational system that cannot be said to be controlled by the right. Even if Marcuse's arguments made sense to many people in 1965, can his ideas be justified on campus today? Modern Marcuseanism. In the decades after Repressive Tolerance was published, a variety of theories and approaches flourished on campus in humanities and social science departments that offered ways of analyzing society through the lens of power relationships among groups. Examples include deconstructionism, post-structuralism, postmodernism, and critical theory. One such theory deserves special mention because its ideas and terminology are widely found in the discourse of today's campus activists. The approach known as intersectionality was advanced by Kimberly Williams Crenshaw, a law professor at UCLA and now at Columbia, where she directs the Center on Intersectionality and Social Policy Studies. In a 1989 essay, Crenshaw noted that a black woman's experience in America is not captured by the summation of the black experience and the female experience. She made her point vividly by analyzing a legal case in which black women were victims of discrimination at General Motors even when the company could show that it hired plenty of black people in factory jobs dominated by men, and plenty of women in clerical jobs dominated by white people. So, even though GM was found not to have discriminated against black people or women, it ended up hiring hardly any black women. Crenshaw's important insight was that you can't just look at a few big main effects of discrimination. You have to look at interactions or intersections. More generally, as explained in a recent book by Patricia Hill Collins and Sirma Bilge, quote, "Intersectionality as an analytic tool examines how power relations are intertwined and mutually constructing. Race, class, gender, sexuality, disability, ethnicity, nation, religion, and age are categories of analysis, terms that reference important social divisions. But they are also categories that gain meaning from power relations of racism, sexism, heterosexism, and class exploitation. End quote. Intersectionality is a theory based on several insights that we believe are valid and useful. Power matters. Members of groups sometimes act cruelly or unjustly to preserve their power. And people who are members of multiple identity groups can face various forms of disadvantage in ways that are often invisible to others. The point of using the terminology of intersectionalism, as Crenshaw said in her 2016 TED Talk, is that where there's no name for a problem, you can't see a problem. And when you can't see a problem, you pretty much can't solve it. Our purpose here is not to critique the theory itself. It is, rather, to explore the effects that certain interpretations of intersectionality may now be having on college campuses. The human mind is prepared for tribalism, and these interpretations of intersectionality have the potential to turn tribalism way up. These interpretations of intersectionality teach people to see bipolar dimensions of privilege and oppression as ubiquitous in social interactions. It's not just about employment or other opportunities, and it's not just about race and gender. Let me describe for you a figure that is sometimes used to teach intersectionality. We modeled it on a figure by Catherine Pauli Morgan, a professor of philosophy at the University of Toronto. You can find it as figure 3.1 on our website, thecoddling.com. Imagine a dot in the center of the page. Now draw a horizontal line through it. Everything above the line is the zone of privilege. Everything below the line is the zone of oppression. Now draw 7 additional lines through the center point, arrayed around it like the spokes on a wheel. Each of these lines is one of the bipolar dimensions or axes of social space. Each line has a label on the privilege side and a label on the oppression side. Here are the 7 pairs of labels. Able-bodied versus disabled, cisgender versus transgender, heterosexual versus gay or lesbian, white versus non-white, male versus female, upper class versus poor, and fertile versus infertile. In an essay describing her approach, Morgan explains that the center point represents a particular individual living at the intersection of many dimensions of power and privilege. The person might be high or low on any of the axes. She defines her terms like this. Privilege involves the power to dominate in systematic ways. Oppression involves the lived, systematic experience of being dominated by virtue of one's position on various particular axes. Morgan draws on the writings of French philosopher Michel Foucault to argue that each of us occupies a point on each of these axes at a minimum, and that this point is simultaneously a locus of our agency, power, disempowerment, oppression, and resistance. The endpoints represent maximum privilege or extreme oppression with respect to a particular axis. She analyzes how 2 of those axes, race and gender, interact to structure schools in ways that privilege the ideas and perspectives of white males. Girls and women, she claims, are effectively a colonized population. They make up a majority of all students, but are forced to live and learn within ideas and institutions structured by white men. Morgan is certainly right that it was mostly white males who set up the educational system and founded nearly all the universities in the United States. Most of these schools once excluded women and people of color. But does that mean that women and people of color should think of themselves as colonized populations today? Would doing so empower them, or would it encourage an external locus of control? Would it make them more or less likely to engage with their teachers in readings, work hard, and benefit from their time in school? More generally, what will happen to the thinking of students who are trained to see everything in terms of intersecting bipolar axes where one end of each axis is marked privilege and the other is oppression? Since privilege is defined as the power to dominate and to cause oppression, these axes are inherently moral dimensions. The people on top are bad, and the people below the line are good. This sort of teaching seems likely to encode the untruth of us versus them directly into students' cognitive schemas. Life is a battle between good people and evil people. Furthermore, there is no escaping the conclusion as to who the evil people are. The main axes of oppression usually point to one intersectional address: straight, white males. An illustration of this way of thinking happened at Brown University in November of 2015, when students stormed the president's office and presented their list of demands to her and the provost, the chief academic officer, generally considered the second highest post. At one point in the video of the confrontation, the provost, a white man, says, "Can we just have a conversation about..." But he's interrupted by shouts of, "No!" and students' finger snaps. One protester offers this explanation for cutting him off. "The problem they're having is that heterosexual white males have always dominated the space." The provost then points out that he himself is gay. The student stutters a bit, but continues on, undeterred by the fact that Brown University was led by a woman and a gay man. "Well, homosexual, it doesn't matter. White males are at the top of the hierarchy." In short, as a result of our long evolution for tribal competition, the human mind readily does dichotomous us-versus-them thinking. If we want to create welcoming, inclusive communities, we should be doing everything we can to turn down the tribalism and turn up the sense of common humanity. Instead, some theoretical approaches used in universities today may be hyperactivating our ancient tribal tendencies, even if that was not the intention of the professor. Of course, some individuals truly are racist, sexist, or homophobic, and some institutions are too, even when the people who run them mean well, if they end up being less welcoming to members of some groups. We favor teaching students to recognize a variety of kinds of bigotry and bias as an essential step toward reducing them. Intersectionality can be taught skillfully, as Crenshaw does in her TED Talk. It can be used to promote compassion and reveal injustices not previously seen. Yet somehow, many college students today seem to be adopting a different version of intersectional thinking and are embracing the untruth of us versus them. Why common enemy identity politics is bad for students. Imagine an entire entering class of college freshmen whose orientation program includes training in the kind of intersectional thinking described previously, along with training in spotting microaggressions. By the end of their first week on campus, students have learned to score their own and others' levels of privilege, identify more distinct identity groups, and see more differences between people. They have learned to interpret more words and social behaviors as acts of aggression. They have learned to associate aggression, domination, and oppression with privileged groups. They have learned to focus only on perceived impact and to ignore intent. How might students at such a school react to the sorts of emails sent by Dean Spellman and Erica Christakis? The combination of common enemy identity politics and microaggression training creates an environment highly conducive to the development of a call-out culture in which students gain prestige for identifying small offenses committed by members of their community and then publicly calling out the offenders. One gets no points, no credit for speaking privately and gently with an offender. In fact, that could be interpreted as colluding with the enemy. Call-out culture requires an easy way to reach an audience that can award status to people who shame or punish alleged offenders. This is one reason social media has been so transformative. There is always an audience eager to watch people being shamed, particularly when it is so easy for spectators to join in and pile on. Life in a call-out culture requires constant vigilance, fear, and self-censorship. Many in the audience may feel sympathy for the person being shamed, but are afraid to speak up, yielding the false impression that the audience is unanimous in its condemnation. Here is how a student at Smith College describes her induction into its call-out culture in the fall of 2014. During my first days at Smith, I witnessed countless conversations that consisted of one person telling the other that their opinion was wrong. The word offensive was almost always included in the reasoning. Within a few short weeks, members of my freshman class had quickly assimilated to this new way of non-thinking. They could soon detect a politically incorrect view and call the person out on their mistake. I began to voice my opinion less often to avoid being berated and judged by a community that claims to represent the free expression of ideas. I learned, along with every other student, to walk on eggshells for fear that I may say something offensive. That is the social norm here. Reports from around the country are remarkably similar. Students at many colleges today are walking on eggshells, afraid of saying the wrong thing, liking the wrong post, or coming to the defense of someone whom they know to be innocent, out of fear that they themselves will be called out by a mob on social media. Connor Friedersdorf, who writes about higher education at The Atlantic, looked into the matter in response to our original Coddling article in 2015. Students told him things like this. Students get worked up over the smallest of issues, which has led to the disintegration of school spirit and the fracture of campus. And this from another student. I probably hold back 90% of the things that I want to say due to fear of being called out. People won't call you out because your opinion is wrong. People will call you out for literally anything. On Twitter today, I came across someone making fun of a girl who made a video talking about how much she loved God and how she was praying for everyone. There were hundreds of comments, rude comments, below the video. It was to the point that they weren't even making fun of what she was standing for. They were picking apart everything. Her eyebrows, the way her mouth moves, her voice, the way her hair was parted. Ridiculous. In this comment, we can begin to see the way that social media amplifies the cruelty and virtue signaling that are recurrent features of call-out culture. Virtue signaling refers to the things people say and do to advertise that they are virtuous. This helps them stay within the good graces of their team. Mobs can rob good people of their conscience, particularly when participants wear masks in a real mob, or are hiding behind an alias or avatar in an online mob. Anonymity fosters de-individuation, the loss of an individual sense of self, which lessens self-restraint and increases one's willingness to go along with the mob. The intellectual devastation wrought by this way of thinking can be seen in a report from Trent Eady, a young Canadian queer activist who escaped from this mindset in 2014. He then wrote an essay titled, "Everything is Problematic, My Journey into the Center of a Dark Political World and How I Escaped." Eady identifies four features of the culture: dogmatism, groupthink, a crusader mentality, and anti-intellectualism. Of greatest relevance to the untruth of us versus them, he wrote, "Thinking this way quickly divides the world into an in-group and an out-group, believers and heathens, the righteous and the wrongchus. Every minor heresy inches you further away from the group. When I was part of groups like this, everyone was on exactly the same page about a suspiciously large range of issues. Internal disagreement was rare." It is difficult to imagine a culture that is more antithetical to the mission of a university. The power of common humanity today. Michelle Alexander, in her best-selling book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness, illustrates what happens to the millions of black men dragged into the criminal justice system, often for possession or use of small amounts of marijuana. They are released into a society where they struggle to find jobs, are disqualified from state benefits, and sometimes face the loss of the right to vote, leading to an undercaste in American society that is in some ways reminiscent of the Jim Crow South. The book has had a powerful impact on the political left, but the issues it raises resonate across the political spectrum. in books like Radley Balko's Rise of the Warrior Cop, The Militarization of America's Police Forces, and FIRE co-founder Harvey Silverglate's Three Felonies a Day, How the Feds Target the Innocent, libertarians have expressed opposition to both over-policing and the excesses of the war on drugs. The conservative group Right on Crime opposes over-criminalization, mass incarceration, and the drug war. There are opportunities for real cooperation on serious but potentially solvable issues. For activists seeking reform, the lesson is to find common ground. Marches and rallies are good for energizing your team, but as Columbia University Professor of Humanities Mark Lilla points out in his book, The Once and Future Liberal, After Identity Politics, they are not enough to bring about lasting change. You have to win elections to do that. And to win elections, you have to draw in very large numbers of people from diverse groups. Lilla argues that the left did that successfully from the presidency of Franklin D. Roosevelt through the Great Society era of the 1960s. But then it took a wrong turn into a new, more divisive, and less successful kind of politics. Instead, they threw themselves into the movement politics of identity, losing a sense of what we share as citizens and what binds us as a nation. An image for Roosevelt liberalism and the unions that supported it was that of two hands shaking. A recurring image of identity liberalism is that of a prism refracting a single beam of light into its constituent colors, producing a rainbow. This says it all. Yet appeals to common humanity still work just as well today as when Dr. King made them. On September 16, 2017, on the National Mall in Washington, D.C., a group of Trump supporters organized a rally they called the Mother of All Rallies Patriot Unification Gathering. Counter-protesters from Black Lives Matter, or BLM, showed up and shouted at the Trump supporters. The Trump supporters shouted back. Someone on stage told the Trump supporters to pay no attention to the counter-protesters. "They don't exist," he said. Hawk Newsom, the leader of the BLM counter-protesters, later said that he expected to stand there with his fist in the air in a very militant way and to exchange insults. Tensions mounted, and onlookers recorded video of the potentially explosive situation. Then the Trump rally organizer, who goes by the name Tommy Gunn, took the stage. "It's about freedom of speech," he said. And in an unexpected move, he invited Newsom and other BLM supporters onto the stage. "We're going to give you 2 minutes of our platform to put your message out," Gunn told Newsom. "Now, whether they disagree or agree with your message is irrelevant. It's the fact that you have the right to have the message." Newsom took the stage. "I am an American," he began, and the crowd cheered. "And the beauty of America is that when you see something broke in your country, you can mobilize to fix it." But then, as he spoke about a black man being killed by police, the crowd began to turn on him. They booed. "Shut up! That was a criminal," a woman shouted. Newsom explained, "We are not anti-cop." "Yes, you are," people shouted. "We're anti-bad cop," Newsom insisted. He still seemed to be losing them. "We don't want handouts," he told the crowd. "We don't want anything that is yours. We want our God-given right to freedom, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." Now they were coming back around. People cheered. Someone in the crowd shouted, "All lives matter," which is usually intended as a rebuke to those who say that black lives matter. But Newsom responded in the tradition of Pauli Murray by drawing a larger circle around everyone in the crowd. "You're right, my brother, you're right, you are so right. All lives matter, right? But when a black life is lost, we get no justice. That is why we say black lives matter. If we really want to make America great, we do it together." The crowd cheered and chanted, "USA, USA." In an instant, the two groups were no longer us and them. Their ideological differences remained, but within that larger circle around them, their enmity melted away. And, at least for a short while, They interacted as fellow human beings and fellow Americans. It kind of restored my faith, Newsom said when interviewed afterward. Two sides that never listened to each other actually made progress today. One of the leaders of Bikers for Trump came up to Newsom afterward and shook his hand. The two men talked and then posed for a photo together, with Newsom holding the other man's young son cradled in his arm. In sum, 1. The human mind evolved for living in tribes that engaged in frequent and often violent conflict. Our modern-day minds readily divide the world into us and them, even on trivial or arbitrary criteria, as Henri Tajfel's psychological experiments demonstrated. 2. Identity politics takes many forms. Some forms, such as that practiced by Martin Luther King Jr. and Paul E. Murray, can be called common humanity identity politics because its practitioners humanize their opponents and appeal to their humanity while also applying political pressure in other ways. 3. Common enemy identity politics, on the other hand, tries to unite a coalition using the psychology embedded in the Bedouin proverb, I against my brothers, I and my brothers against my cousins, I and my brothers and my cousins against the world. It is used on the far right as well as the far left. 4. Intersectionality is a popular intellectual framework on campuses today. Certain versions of it teach students to see multiple axes of privilege and oppression that intersect. While there are merits to the theory, the way it is interpreted and practiced on campus can sometimes amplify tribal thinking and encourage students to endorse the untruth of us versus them. Life is a battle between good people and evil people. 5. Common enemy identity politics, when combined with microaggression theory, produces a call-out culture in which almost anything one says or does could result in a public shaming. This can engender a sense of walking on eggshells, and it teaches students habits of self-censorship. Call-out cultures are detrimental to students' education and bad for their mental health. Call-out cultures and us-versus-them thinking are incompatible with the educational and research missions of universities, which require free inquiry, dissent, evidence-based argument, and intellectual honesty. This concludes part one of this book. In these three chapters, we presented three really bad ideas and showed how each one meets the three criteria for being called a great untruth, which we laid out in the introductory chapter. It contradicts ancient wisdom, it contradicts modern psychological research on flourishing, and it harms the individuals and communities that embrace it. In part two, we'll examine some dramatic recent events on campus that have been incomprehensible to many outside observers. We'll show that these events become much more intelligible once you understand the three great untruths and their effects on individuals and on groups. Part 2. Bad Ideas in Action. Chapter 4. Intimidation and Violence. A quotation from Nelson Mandela. When we dehumanize and demonize our opponents, we abandon the possibility of peacefully resolving our differences and seek to justify violence against them. On the night of February 1st, 2017, the University of California's Berkeley campus exploded into violence. An estimated 1,500 protesters surrounded the building where Milo Yiannopoulos, a young British gay Trump supporter, was scheduled to speak. Yiannopoulos was formerly an editor at Breitbart News, a principal outlet of the alt-right movement that had come to national prominence during the previous year's presidential campaign. He had been banned from Twitter the summer before when Twitter concluded that he had violated its policy regarding inciting or engaging in the targeted abuse or harassment of others. Yiannopoulos was a skilled provocateur, a master of the art of triggering outrage and then using that outrage to embarrass his opponents and advance his goals. The protesters' goal was to prevent the speech from happening. Many of them came from local radical anarchist groups that called themselves anti-fascists, or Antifa. UC Berkeley officials claimed that only about 150 of the protesters were responsible for the vandalism and violence that ensued.